Good evening, Mel.
It's been quite a roller coaster ride with you, Crystal, I have to say. Just watching everything unfold the last few years.
Yeah, I was sort of looking over the old podcast, figuring out, because it's almost 3 years now since the first episode that we recorded. Because we sort of didn't start recording till early 2021. But I've been in a bunch of spaces in the last week because I'm not on Twitter, which I refuse to call X anytime soon, very often, but I've been popping my head back in to attend some of the spaces from various people we've sort of talked with before. And maybe before we actually get into some of the topics I brought up, I don't know if you were sort of catching what was going on yesterday anyway, but wow, it was a hot mess in the spaces.
What I got from the hot mess in the spaces is that there is a lot of infighting happening. Just everyone's so passionate, right? It's such a hot button topic, and we've been fighting this fight for so long. But yeah. You're right. Like, we've discussed this about, you know, giving each other grace and supporting each other and advocacy. And we can't fight the fight if we keep on fighting each other.
Well, and it's challenging because I think, as like a wearing my psychology hat looking at this, I'm sort of a, it's my thing, and I'm an expert in taking different perspectives, even ones that I don't necessarily always agree with. And listening to this sort of breakout that was happening across the spaces yesterday, I can see various viewpoints, and I wanted to tug on a few of them because they are related to some of the stuff we're going to talk about today. And I think we would be remiss not to mention that a lot of this is coming out in the context of the long COVID hearing that happened in the Senate in the United States, which happened, I think, like 2-3 days ago. It was on the 18th, I believe. And that itself has brought to head a lot of the differing things that have been happening within the spaces. I don't know if maybe if you agree with that or disagree with that.
For people who are trying to get motivated to stay in the activism, if people don't fully understand and just see it as infighting, then it's going to turn people away, right?
I agree. And I think, as I said, there's these multiple components to it, many that we've talked about over the years that sort of are combining into this clusterfuck that we see. I think one, if we just, you know, I'm going to sort of separate these out, but they're all cross-pollinating at the same time, if we think about it in that way. But the first being those who've been dealing with the fight for adequate research and services for specific post-viral illnesses or illnesses such as ME/CFS. So that's the myalgic encephalomyelitis. I'm terrible at saying it. That's why I always say ME/CFS, with the CFS being chronic fatigue syndrome. So this is in the context of many individuals who have sort of been battling with ME/CFS for a long time, have not been able to get the adequate resources, and saw that sort of psychologization of the illness itself, being told that sort of it was in their heads and all these things. So that's one piece, right, is that there's already these sort of pre-existing individuals who have had to fight that battle for a really long time. And that was one of the first topics that sort of came up in the infighting, as I would say. And I'm not going to sort of mention the specific groups that were being talked about, because to be honest, I don't know enough about either of those groups to take a firm stance on anything involved in it. So I'm just talking about more of the actual issues that I can label. So there's this feeling from what I'm seeing that some individuals feel like it's not necessarily helpful for all post-viral illnesses and other things to be lumped into one group. So they're sort of making this argument that when we don't adequately resource each individual thing, it's easier for them to sweep it under the rug and sort of just have. So one of the things talked about in the long COVID Senate hearing was the idea of this Institute for Post-Viral Illnesses. And so you have these sort of two camps where one would say, yes, like, please, any resources towards these things is beneficial at this point because of how ignored they've been. And then the alternative viewpoint, I would say, that is if we allow them to just lump these things in together, then we're never going to have adequate resourcing for either of them. So I'll start with, does that make sense to you, Mel?
Yes. But however, as someone who suffers from chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia, can I just say, like, any start is a good start, guys? Like, how about we just start?
Well, and that will bring me to the second issue of how that relates to what was coming up in the long COVID hearing and why that infighting was the very accurate fact that the sort of level of funding proposed for $1 billion per year is insufficient. And I think that most people that have looked into these issues and know the pervasiveness of when we're specifically talking about long COVID, that will be nowhere near the sort of contributions that are going to be needed. So I absolutely get what you just said and sort of that point of anything at this point is better than no research ongoing, no treatment. But I also get from the perspective of when we let funders, and I've seen this, so I speak from it in that way, is that when funders have the opportunity to say, well, we give $1 billion towards that a year, we are doing something, it also gives them a pathway to not do anything further. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I'm going to share that this last summer, while we were on break, I actually participated in a Canada-wide study from my pain specialist that signed me up. And it was intranasal spray of oxytocin, the love hormone, which is meant to help manage your pain. And I did 10 weeks of that. And it's a Canada-wide study. There's a doctor in BC who's a pain specialist and a doctor in Nova Scotia who runs this Canada-wide study. If you're listening and you are a chronic pain sufferer, please ask your GP to sign you up for it and inquire about it, because you can qualify for the study. But basically, they let me in, like, spray oxytocin in my nose for 10 weeks. And I had to do the self-report and the study and the pain. And it works. However, it's after the 10 weeks, my pain rebounded horribly, because guess what? You no longer have that test drug that they give you. And Health Canada is nowhere near in any space being able to provide intranasal oxytocin to any Canadian. It's not approved in Health Canada anywhere. After I participated in this 10-week study, it was great. I was pain-free for 10 weeks during the summer. But then after, the rebound was horrible, because one, you've gone into, like, withdrawal. And you can't get this drug anywhere, the oxytocin hormone. But, like, that's where we're at in Canada for understanding pain management. That's it. There's no drugs for managing chronic pain. The treatments that are available to you as a chronic pain sufferer, and I'm going to speak from experience, that I've been suffering from chronic pain since 2008. Okay. And the best that can be done to manage this type of lack of energy, systemic pain, systemic inflammation, is like monthly injections down your spine with either cortisol or anesthesia from your pain specialist. And that's if you're lucky to get in to see a pain specialist. With there's a 3-year waiting list right now. I mean, Crystal, you work in a pain clinic, you know. But we're so far behind. We're not anywhere near for treatment right now.
No, and as you said, like monthly injections, stuff like nerve ablation, like there's very few options right now for chronic pain patients. And yeah, so in my clinic, there is a chronic pain management program, but the wait list is roughly about 2 years now, I believe, for someone to get in after referral. And it's, you know, it's been talked about in discussion of these sorts of programs that it's easier for patients, and we've seen them do so, get in to talk to a physician about MAID in 6 to 8 weeks versus waiting to get into a program for 2 years and then not necessarily knowing how that's going to result in pain management for individuals. So, yeah, when it comes to things like chronic pain, which we've been working at for a while, there's little to nothing. So imagine for these other illnesses that we're talking about that oftentimes are not even recognized or moderated within the medical system right now, that it's going to be a long-term planning and sustenance that's needed for development of these things. And I think that's why some of the critiques that came from this initiative that was proposed in the $1 billion is that it's nowhere near what needs to be done in terms of figuring out, you know, diagnostics, treatments, prevention, all those sorts of things. It was positive, I would say, that Dr. Al-Ali, I'm hoping I'm saying that right, who was one of the physicians, he's a clinical epidemiologist at Washington University. He was speaking about long COVID because he was part of the first team, I believe, that was characterizing it. And he acknowledged that the best way to be dealing with long COVID is to be preventing it in the first place by preventing COVID infections. But that's going to require many different methods of doing, whether it's including different types of vaccines, other types of protective vaccines from illnesses in general, improving building ventilation, which we've talked about for a long time, right? Like both cleaning the air and preventing through other methods, whether it's medical or treatment-based. And there's no really approved treatments at this time for long COVID. And again, I can say I see that in my clinic where people are very lost on what to do with long COVID right now. And we do have people coming in with diagnoses of long COVID, or I'm even suggesting, you know, sometimes I have psych assessments where a lot of the outcomes are coming alongside when they have their COVID infection. And even as a non-medical doctor, as a clinical psychologist, I'm suggesting that they go back and screen for certain types of medical things and diagnostics to check for long COVID, because I'm not going to say that someone has a mental illness like depression or other things when I know, based on the timing and other forms of evidence in their medical documentation, that there's a very real possibility that long COVID could be part of that picture. But that's not something a lot of people are even aware of enough to do, right? That's not something that the other psychs are doing, right? This is because I read like 400 systematic reviews and papers on COVID and continue to do so. And, you know, people, leadership in my clinic is aware of the long COVID research, some of this stuff, but there is still that vast separation between that and practice and real prevention. Like I'm the only person in a respirator right now in my teams, right? And I've noticed over the last 2 weeks, because there's been a lot of sickness, and I put up in the nest in Canada, right? Tara Moriarty's data from today that like one in 13 people in Canada right now likely have COVID based on the info, and a lot of sickness going through the clinics and stuff like that. But still, when I wear my respirator to the meetings, it's like, well, are you sick? And my response is always, no, I'm trying to not get sick. And then they, you know, look at me like I'm a little wacky still. That's still wild to me, right? Like that's wild. And this is a health setting, right? Where I'm physiotherapists and occupational therapists and physicians. There's one other physician that wears her respirator to the meetings and does sort of online intakes and stuff like that. But outside of the two of us, it's like I'm assumed to be sick for wearing a mask. And when I tell them that, no, I'm trying to prevent that, I still get blank looks.
That's incredible. It's absolutely incredible that we're like in year 5 of the pandemic and they still, it's just such poor public health messaging. I just cannot believe that people have like decided to live in such denial that when you choose to protect yourself and your family, that you're looked at like you're strange.
Well, I want to, you know, and I try not to sort of name drop things I'm mad about in here, but I feel like given that she says things so openly right now that I won't feel bad about doing that. But I don't know if you've seen some of the latest posts by Nora Loretto. And I have had a lot of respect for her across the pandemic in the sense in that she was one of the few people that was really loudly talking about long-term care deaths, right? And most people are aware that my grandma died in some of the initial waves in December 2020. And, you know, she wrote a book on COVID. But some of the recent posts when people are sort of talking about, you know, are there masks at your events or all these things? And her response is like, I don't need to wear a mask everywhere I go. Like very, very dismissive of people. And for me, it's like this juxtaposition of like, you are making money from a book on the back of COVID and people are suffering and they're looking for people to care and to want to help them. And I think it's okay that we have personal struggles with it. And there's times that we don't do these things. What I don't ever support are people who come out publicly and fight against measures actively that sort of in their need to defend their own actions, try to state that these things are not helpful, not necessarily, right? Like there was a post in response to someone sort of calling her in about this that, you know, if I am not testing positive and I don't have symptoms, I don't need to wear a mask when I'm out of the house. And it was like, you're ignoring asymptomatic spread. You're ignoring these things. And not only that, says that it's unscientific to do so and there's no support for it. And for me, it's like, that's a step too far. That is letting your own feelings about being called out about stuff muddy the fact that there are a better way to do things. And I don't think you have to do it perfectly. But I do think that there's a responsibility on those of us who choose to try to support things to be open about what we maybe don't get right and acknowledge that and acknowledge the harms that it can cause, because we know that forward transmission is a thing. We know that the choices that we make as individuals can impact other people, right? And to try to just push that aside and like just cheer on, you know, that you want to have a book event with no masks. I mean, you do you. Ultimately, she's like a free human, but you can't really be surprised that people are upset about it. I don't know, Mel. I'd love to hear your thoughts. I try not to like call people out directly, but she's been very hostile in some of her responses to people trying to tell her why they're concerned, where long COVID is in this, why it matters. And instead of just like taking a step back and having some humility and listening, just really taking that individualistic point of view. And again, I think if it was probably a different person, I would just roll my eyes. But it's like, you wanted to write a book on COVID. You wanted to be a person that was at the forefront of this. And that doesn't really seem to be a care unless it's about planning an event associated with it.
The first question that pops in my mind when I hear you speak about this is, does this individual understand how COVID is transmitted? Because let me tell you something, I know you as a professor yourself, when you take in work from your students, it's very clear which are the ones who fully understand the material when they write something. And then there are those that copy and paste and regurgitate, right? Just to get that A. So there's a very clear difference between individuals who fully understand the material and demonstrate that they understand the material. And then there's individuals who only copy and paste just to get that A. And right? That's the difference.
Well, and I don't know if you remember some of these conversations, but I do know that I had expressed some distaste for some posts that were made by the same person several years ago, I think a year or two ago, because, again, they'd been a vast proponent of masking and these sorts of things and testing and all that. But when it came to sort of their kids going back to school and getting to a back to normal life, it's like a switch flipped and the concerns were no longer there. And I get that we have pandemic fatigue. I mean, the people that think those of us who are masking in 2024 like it, like to stand out, like to be the one that's always different, most of us don't. Like, I don't. I would love to just be able to go in with my team and have, you know, a normal team meeting and not have to worry about it. But at the end of the day, that's not where we're at. And me pretending that we are doesn't benefit anyone and can actively harm people. And it's not within my own sort of cognitive structure to continue doing that, even if it's hard. But again, I think we've had this conversation before that I think a lot of us that continue on this were a little weird to start with, in the sense of little neurodivergence or oddities about us. So we sort of knew what it was like to stick out a little bit. And this is just one more way where we've been like, meh, well, the consequences of not are so much greater than standing out that we don't really care, right? But it's interesting that we've made no gains in respect to people being willing to mask in testing and in the sort of things that we want to see. But there is a crack in the research coming out about how bad it is, right? Like, I have noticed that over the last maybe 6 months, that there are more conversations that are ongoing about the long-term effects of long COVID, about the things that we need. A lot of it's still falling into unheard places, but I do feel like more is being talked about. I don't know if you get that sense, Mel.
Yeah, slowly but surely you see it in the mainstream science magazines, right? There was the Peace and Time magazine on how many times being infected with COVID is bad, and you get long COVID. And then multiple pieces in National Geographic about long COVID and COVID infections and brain damage, lots on the brain there in National Geographic. Teen Vogue has been amazing for coverage of up in...
I'm just grabbing their article right now.
Yeah, like, come on, way to go, Teen Vogue, right? Like, they're always, like, actually right on the ball. But, yeah, it's slowly coming to head. I mean, we're no longer the crazy fringe people that they claim we were, like, 3 years ago. Remember when 3 years ago when we told them it was airborne and that it's cumulative damage and what happened to me and how, like, every time you get infected, it knocks your system down, right? And, you know, 3 years ago at the time, we didn't know what it was called, immune dysregulation, right? I could only tell people what happened to me after being infected, being on the Diamond Princess early in 2020, and what happened to my entire family, right? But, I mean, we watched what happened, and we tried to warn people as research was coming out, and the names we were called, Crystal. we were called what? Extremists, on the fringe, fearmongers, everything up and above. And now people are like, oh no, they're in their fourth season and their messaging hasn't changed. It's the same warning. Don't get infected. It's airborne. Wear a respirator. Wear a proper mask.
You know, I'm sort of pulling up articles as well. So I put the Teen Vogue one in the nest, which is, Teen Vogue's been like on top of it, which is hilarious. I'm also super stoked that Teen Vogue is doing that because of their audience in terms of having a younger audience and people that will be picking this stuff up. But 100%. They have that article that I put in there, COVID isn't going anywhere, masking up could save my life. And it's on a series. It's a disability visibility series that talks about why, it matters and sort of how public health works, talks about long COVID, all that sort of stuff, in the context of sort of what we're dealing with now, which is amazing to see. But the point you're talking about in terms of reinfections, right? That, you know, we've had research for years now at this time. Like, I'm looking at information about, you know, a study from Nature, as you mentioned, in early 2023, where it's talking about the fact that each subsequent infection can increase your risk of developing chronic health issues like diabetes, kidney disease, organ failure, and mental health problems, right? Even if your sort of brushes with the virus are considered mild and you don't have a ton of symptoms at that time, it's akin to playing Russian roulette, right? The point is to, again, avoid infection, not to try to continue to pursue. And the fact that this is still in the fucking vocabulary right now, the idea of this hybrid immunity, which we have seen does not exist, right? I can't remember who I saw talking about that earlier this week, but I was just like, are we still doing this? We're still doing it, eh?
They're still doing it. I mean, the fact that they are still pushing kids to get infected, right, with this, and test scores all across the board globally have dropped, except for, let me point out, the Asian countries that masked, right?
And they're still blaming the, like, short restrictions that happened, like, over 3 years ago. People are still blaming that.
Yeah, no, that doesn't account for the developmental delays that you're seeing in these COVID babies that have been multiply infected now, right? They're seeing developmental delays in infants, speech delays, you know, that are common to like traumatic brain injuries in children. You cannot blame it on a 6 week lockdown that occurred when they didn't. It wasn't even a real lockdown.
Don't tell my fellow people in Alberta that, because woo, they'd be angry.
I mean, we just had like Cindy on last week or 2 weeks ago, and we're talking about class switching, right? About how the vaccine switches changes your DNA. And what did Tucker Carlson go on just go on air this last week saying there was this ridiculous post about having a Chinese baby
I did see that one. That's awkward for everybody involved. Well, and it relates back to what we were talking about 2 weeks ago with Cindy in terms of that people don't understand the mechanisms of a lot of these things, and the proliferation of sort of misinformation is easily done, right? Again, we've talked about this so many times, that if people are in a place of cognitive dissonance and somebody feeds them a piece of information that lets them feel better about their own behavior and ignore the things that they should be doing, they're going to take that and run with that, because people don't want to live in a state of cognitive dissonance, right? They want to minimize that cognitive dissonance. So if, official people come out and say, well, yeah, there's people with long COVID, but most people are not going to be affected by this and it's going to be fine, right? Like, people are going to assume that they're most people, even if that's an inaccurate statement. It doesn't actually matter that it's inaccurate. It's giving them the scaffolding and the structure that they need to make those decisions for themselves, even if they're negative decisions. And the problem is that you can't necessarily back erase that from people. Like, you can't then give them a bunch of research studies and say like, hey, blah, 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 because they just ignore that at that point. And to be honest, the government has sucked at responding to this pandemic. So there's very real frustration and concerns with how the governments have dealt with this pandemic. And people, even if they do realize that it's very bad in terms of long COVID, that gives them even more reason to not listen to the government or trust them because they know how poorly they dealt with it. So people are not able to dissect these statements and take out only the true parts of it and throw away the rest. They sort of just use it en masse, and that's where we see the problems that we do. But you even see, like, I have it posted on my wall when we were talking about the topics for it, is that, you know, the Canadian guidelines for post-COVID-19 conditions, so these first set of guidelines that came out. So if we look at this first part, so prevention of post-COVID-19, so how do we not give people long COVID? Public health officials and healthcare professionals should educate the public and patients on current ways to prevent infection or reinfection with COVID. So Mel, what do you see as the problem here?
The problem is that the people have already been told that COVID doesn't get you sick. It's no big deal. It's just the flu. It's just a cold. And your kids don't get sick. The damage has already been done. So, well, it's like trying to reel them back in after you've told them, don't worry about it. Oh, by the way, it causes brain damage and organ damage and vascular damage. No one's listening at this point.
Well, this is, the publication is January 15th, 2024, right? So this is very new, first set of guidelines, whole bunch of people listed on as authors. The other problem is, despite this recommendation, do you see any of our government agencies, provincial or national, actually trying to prevent COVID? We don't even have masks in hospitals.
No, we don't have masks in long-term care homes. Like, Justin Trudeau's going around visiting people in, you know, old age care homes. He's not wearing a respirator in those photos. So it's just, it's whatever's modeled to us from our leaders. That's what's happening.
Right. So it's, we can have these like really beautiful recommendations made, but when literally people from the bottom to the very top of leadership are not enacting any sort of action to follow through on these recommendations, we are not going to get anywhere. Right? We are simply not going to get anywhere. We have to have them acting on this at a large scale level, right? Okay, so we have a good practice statement. So how do you communicate this? How do you have knowledge translation of these principles now to family physician offices, to hospitals, to government buildings, to spaces where vulnerable people are going to be? How are you going to make sure that the large scale and small scale leaders have the tools and the knowledge and the actual steps for them to take to enact these things? Because having a website that says we should prevent COVID infection is not doing any of that. It's a great start that it's written down somewhere, because prior to January 15th, 2024, there was just complete denial of this fact. But how do we actually knowledge translate this? And it comes down to that question. I hate when I sound conspiratorial, but sometimes it fits, is that they simply don't want to translate that information, right? It's that this exists. They know it exists. They clearly know that there's methods we can be utilizing to have prevention, as shown in the long COVID hearing in the Senate. But they don't want to do that. That's a lot of work. It's a lot of backtracking. It's a lot of costs. It's all these things that they simply don't care to do right now.
They're saying there's going to be no more mandates whatsoever. And it's really a dialing back of all
kinds. I mean, that's great. So say measures. Like, say we just get like a total bioweapon that hits across our country, and we're not going to have mandates, right? We don't want to restrict people's freedom. Like, the idea that there's not going to be long-term consequences to this stance, or the actual hubris and like genuine narcissism that it takes to suggest that there's never going to be a situation in the future where we need this, and to completely underwrite everything associated with it, is bonkers. And it's bonkers when the scientific community has been telling us for decades that the worse that sort of the global climate and capacity gets, that the more of these sorts of things that we're going to see, it's just complete nonsense. It's nonsense.
Or how about the fact that a bioweapon is being spread willfully everywhere right now, and we're being gaslighted to ignore it until a future disease X comes, when this was actually a disease X. I mean, we might as well jump to the next topic about that, what the FBI released, right? When we're talking about, was it a natural origin or is it lab safety? This was like a lab leak accident, right? And there's that biosafety forum coming up in a few hours, Crystal.
It already happened and it's recorded. Oh. So I put it up in the Nest.
Oh, good. Oh, yeah, that was 10 hours ago.
Yeah, it's with a bunch of experts on that. And then I also put up Fisman, I don't know how to say his name, his sort of notes about it. So that's there as well. But I've also shared just recently the Perzada post that he made about the FOI request that was completed in response to this. In terms of the different pieces of information that continue to come out about the idea of this being the lab leak and a non-natural sort of virus that has occurred. And this is something that we talked about a lot, right? Like we've talked about that it was knowing even just the history of gain of function research and things that were occurring when COVID happened, that it wasn't unreasonable, right? And to sort of look for the evidence and look at those sorts of things. But I mean, we definitely got called crazy at that point for suggesting something like that, or even to sort of wait for the evidence to come in. But again, there's more and more information sort of coming out about what has happened. And I think I saw another recent article that there had been like full upload of the genome, I think in like December, before the pandemic hit widely. So the information was there, but nothing ever really happened with it. So there's all these pieces of it, right? And I put up all this information because I'm not the best person to talk about it, but there's these various forms of information. So you can look at the FOI information on Perzada's tweet from the person who requested all that information. And then also listen to sort of those experts in the space that they held today, actually summarizing a lot of this stuff. But I think it comes back to, again, we just see that relationship of if you are questioning what is sort of the dominant narrative, particularly from those in power, that you're going to get called names, which also rolls me right into the disaster of the Canadian Institute for Health Research post that was made. Mel, did you see that?
I mean, at this point, we should be used to being called names, right? Like we were called names all for all kinds of things, but like we remain correct. Like, I mean,
well, not I
saw
even...
I saw in my open source intelligence analysis, like something was coming overseas. It was spreading widely after the 2019 military Olympics in Wuhan. Something was spreading, right? Something was coming. I tried to warn people, you know, I wrote an intelligence report, submitted it even in the summer saying, hey, something's coming. It's so weird. Hey, look, China and Germany, they're doing biosafety drills in the fall of 2019. What's going on there, guys? We should be paying attention. You know, like there were signs everywhere for people who were monitoring signal intelligence and saw things happening. And that's why, you know, I kept doing what I was doing on my Twitter. And that's how we met, Crystal, right? Because you were doing your own advocacy and I was doing my advocacy going, hey, listen, something's not right. We shouldn't be letting it spread in schools to let it get to the kids. Something's not right. And even with all the new FOI research and all the stuff coming out, yeah, this virus is looking a lot like a result of a lab leak because how well it binds to ACE2 receptors, like that's just abnormal. You know, how there's different pieces of DNA in this virus that doesn't belong. It lacks the evolutionary receipts, you know, and yet, you know, it is being weaponized and used in our society in such a way where it's convenient at this moment to desensitize us to all this death. And instead of us fighting amongst each other about, one, where this virus is coming from and where the funding should be going to, you know, we really should be discussing how come we are still allowing this biosafety level 3 viral pathogen spread amongst our children and our families, and how do we stop it immediately?
I mean, we've been the subject of many names. That's been a good time in my life. Just the various names that come with trying to genuinely like put forward what we see as evidence and sort of the patterns there. But again, people don't like challenges to the way that they think of things, and that's part of it.
They don't like female voices. They don't like females telling them what they see. They don't like it. Let's be honest.
Well, and I think you can relate that to even the response there's been to the movement for more research and calls for things like ME-CFS, CFS-FS, whoo, my words there, but also post-viral, right? Is that you see a lot of advocacy and people speaking out are females, and that's often responded to in a certain way. But this is where, and actually that sort of dovetails back into the CIHR post where, you know, I've put up the screenshot I have because they deleted it after they got so much shit. But they put out this post yesterday with the meme of sort of Ryan Gosling looking unimpressed and stating that how they feel when people are doing their own research. And you could see sort of the responses to it in that of a lot of the responses to it were people coming from the place of patient advocacy, right? That they have had to fight tooth and nail for diagnostics, for treatment, for recognition of many things that have been wrong with them. And my response to CIHR was like, it's sort of unbelievable that you post this when we know of the paternalism that's occurred in medicine and the advocacy that's been required of many groups across time to get recognized for the needs that they have and to even be believed. We even know sort of the standard of practice for females just in general getting sort of medical help can be lowered because a lot of the medical research that's been done has been done on males, and females don't necessarily operate the same way. What a surprise. Right. Even if we look to the base differences in how often heart attacks get recognized in females versus males, right, that there are these differences that have occurred. So for CIHR to sort of come out and say that, it's them not thinking it through. What I suspect is that they were sort of, whoever posted that in that moment was thinking about the people we often deal with, right, that we will literally put research. I put actual research papers in there. Like, I've done my own research. I've listened to some YouTube videos and all that stuff. But to me, even mocking those people misses the point of how poor is our public health? How poor are the systems that are developing and our methods for dealing with this? That is what people are turning to. That is how people feel. What science is and sort of what's represented in that is like, this is a failure on all fronts of public health. So then for public health to mock the fact that people don't even trust their systems, to me just seems so off the mark, ironic that they don't understand the fact that people have ended up in this place because of how shitty our public health has been, right? How misrepresentative they've been about the issues that they've allowed and fostered the exact thing that they're calling out, right? Like, that's literally a result of how bad public health has been, is that the group of people who have been part of anti-vaccination campaigns and sort of anti-prevention measures, that has allowed that to proliferate because of how bad public health response has been. And now they turn around and mock it. It's like, I don't think they understand what they've done, right? And then they came out and had this sort of political apology of they're sorry and they have a group that works with patients. I'm like, you guys are fucking tools. Just no accountability for these places, right? And these are the same group, I think. Oh, someone posted it earlier. Who was that? Barry Hunt, I think. Yeah, I reposted it. You know, the same CIHR that had the conflict of interest, lack of oversight, and good judgment when they funded and participated in the now infamous, abysmal, debunked, disgraced, discredited, and biased fake N95 versus surgical mask study during the airborne pandemic, right? They need to, like, walk themselves back and take a look at themselves real hard before they start mocking the people that are only in this place because of the misinformation they've put out themselves.
It's a scary place to be in a worldwide pandemic when you have the people who are supposed to be leading the way mocking and insulting people who are just trying to find out answers, and those who lack the skills because of a crumbling public education system.
Right. Like, why is CIHR not coming out and being like, wow, so many people feel the need to do their own research. What could we do better? How do we knowledge translate? How do we do this to a level that will make people understand and listen? Nah, they're posting memes mocking the people. Great. Great.
Yeah, they're not approaching anything with a growth mindset, that's for sure. It's a lot of punching down and divisionism, but that's exactly what they want to create, right? You have, you know, when we talked about 2 weeks ago, we'll circle back to the IgG4 paper, how it's deliberately being misused, right? And we called it. Lo and behold, a week later, Tucker Carlson comes out and he goes on air and he's like, yeah, it changes your DNA. And then it spurred a whole bunch of crazy posts about how it can change your kid's DNA and how you can end up with a Chinese kid. And then it's like, what? Okay, but if you take away the shock and like the what the hell is going on, people, you zoom out and you'd be like, okay, how can there be such a vacuum of ignorance? And I can say, as an educator, you look at this and you're like, wow, is this because there's a lack? Well, there's obviously the lack of funding for public education for the last 20 years. You know, this has to do with a lack of science literacy, a lack of access to post-secondary education and upper education, making it like almost impossible unless you want to put yourself hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt to access that education. And this is exactly what we end up with. Like this vacuum of ignorance that just gets to be filled with whoever has the loudest microphone. You know, like you knew it was a problem when they took away Sesame Street on PBS and put it on HBO, and only people who could afford HBO and their kids had access to Sesame Street. And you knew there was already a war on education and knowledge right there. And we were seeing it in real time, how it affects us in a crisis situation, because this is the crisis situation we find ourselves in as humanity right now. And we've created this problem for ourselves because the last 25 years or so, we've underfunded education. And now we're seeing the after effects, sequelae effects of that affecting us in it's affecting us in all areas, but especially this huge knowledge vacuum that is being filled with conspiracy theories, QAnon. But that's exactly what it's being used. They're weaponizing this vacuum.
Well, and the very responses such as that from CIHR facilitate that, right? When our leaders are ones that lack humility, that lack the ability to integrate various viewpoints and perspectives, that lack the ability to truly educate the population with appropriate information, those are the type of people that you are breeding, right? Like people, this is their model, is public health agencies that mock people for not having information when they themselves have not been providing the appropriate information, right? That they don't recognize the things that they've gotten wrong, that they sort of just push forward with whatever they want to in that moment and not recognize the destruction that they've caused along the way, right? Like, we could have a whole podcast on the destruction that has come from that discredited paper and the ways that it got misused and how it's still being cited daily on Twitter for why people shouldn't wear masks.
It's so counterintuitive for you to not wear a mask during an airborne pandemic. It's just wow. The cognitive dissonance is so strong that people would argue with you that there's no edge to the cliff as they happily walk over it. You know, it's okay, so here's the question. How do we get past this cognitive dissonance hump?
Oh, what a question, Mel. One I think about
of living in pure denial and anger and sarcasm, because that's how people are dealing with the information right now.
They're in the dark of the night. Do you want to know what my answer to myself is? Is that we probably hope for social media to collapse. Like, I say that, you know, partially in jest, partially not, because what I actually see is like a primary facilitator of everything we've seen in this pandemic is the proliferation of misinformation, right? Is the ability for these tiny pieces of information that are not true, or a voice that should really be stamped out but is able to have hundreds of thousands of followers that can spew lies and spew this sort of disinformation all the time, that has changed the trajectory of the pandemic experience in such a significant way. I can't fathom how we get out of it sometimes. And like, that's really disheartening to say. And clearly I believe that there is at some level, because I still keep doing this. I refuse to give up and be in denial. But it's a fucking uphill battle. I think it's positive that we have seen it start to break sort of that facade, in terms of we do see research being talked about. We see things like the long COVID Senate hearing. And I think it's naturally going to start to shift the conversation, because it will become unignorable. And that's unfortunately something we've talked about before, right? Is that it's genuinely going to be something they can't ignore, because so many people will be infected, because enough years are going to go by where we don't have enough staff, where healthcare has collapsed, where things have gotten bad, and they can't keep, I mean, some people will, but trying to blame it on the 6 weeks of shutdowns that happened will make no sense when we see how many people actively have long COVID and those sorts of things. And I don't know that we're anywhere close to that yet, because what I keep thinking about is now is actually probably a worse time for the outcomes than it was 2 years ago, because so many people are not getting vaccinated anymore. So many people are not taking any sort of prevention measure, and they're getting multiple infections right now. And we know that sort of the risk goes up during those time periods. So yeah, I mean, I hate to say like, stick around and we'll see what happens in a few years, because the really tragic part is people are going to lose their lives while trying to do that. But it seems like it's slowly shifting, that people are starting to hear that message. What we do with it in this complete clusterfuck of a global environment, I don't know, Mel. Do you have a solution that we could shake on people and spray at them?
No, I have to agree with you. It's going to take more dead people. And unfortunately, it's going to look like more dead kids, right? We just had another child die in BC from secondary infections.
Well, and like,
it's in Ontario.
It can sound like laissez-faire to say just more dead people, but like, we say that knowing that could be us.
Yeah.
Right? That all of us are at risk of that. That, you know, I could get a COVID infection and maybe my organs just give out, or I get another autoimmune disease, or those sorts of things. And that's just like the world we're living in right now, that we are dealing with that on a constant basis. And that sucks. right? It sucks that we're still in the middle of a pandemic and that half the time nobody's recognizing that. But we keep doing it, right? Because it's better to recognize it and keep doing this than to go back to what people think is a normal life. But we can see all around us at any given moment, it's not normal. It's not normal when 4 or 5 out of 10 people in my team meeting has a like permacough sniffle, is unmasked and at work.
Oh, they have the 100-day cough.
Right?
Yeah.
And this is not even just saying that it's all COVID, because there's lots of influenza, lots of RSV, which again is something that we talked about was going to happen, because despite what the asshat on Twitter earlier, I can't remember his name, said about there being like no immune problems from COVID, that's demonstrably false from the research now, right? That there are effects from acute infection and for some people long after. And we don't know if that will ever go away for the people that are dealing with it long term. So it's very disingenuous for people to keep acting like an acute infection with COVID, even if mild, is all there is to it, because it's not. And again, we have enough research long term now that shows that.
Yeah, it's we took a break simply because we were just waiting for the research to come out and catch up, right? Because otherwise we would just be repeating the same stuff that we've been warning about for 3 years. But it is, it's waiting for the cognitive dissonance to fade, but that will only happen when something shocks them out of their apathy, really.
Yeah.
It has to be some sort of event.
Well, and I think it's hard because there are events already, right? But nobody associates any of these things. Like, I think, again, to the Alberta situation where they withdrew Alberta from the kidney matching for donation, right, this month. People who are waiting for a kidney transplant will not be part of the match because... Alberta lacks the surgical capacity to be providing those surgeries anymore. That to me is huge, right?
So what do those people do? Do they have to go out of province? Like, how does that work?
But they're residents here, right? So can they look at moving somewhere else? Yeah, but they probably have to have the 3-month residency and then get the healthcare card in other provinces and all that sort of stuff. They might not have that time, right? And the more things that happen like that, like Alberta, as much as I lived in British Columbia, know how bad it is there. Alberta is in its own clusterfuck right now because of the plans that they have to sort of dismantle the Alberta health services as they have them right now, right? Like before they had all sort of care under Alberta Health Services, but the premier is suggesting breaking it down now, right, into different segments where acute services like hospitals will still be AHS, but everything else will be pieced out. So there's, you know, addiction and mental health is going to be its own corporate identity, it sounds like, and then family practice will be its own one, and then long-term care will be its own one. Well, great. I'm sure that's going to improve it. Right now, having even more figureheads and CEOs that oversee it and the lack of continuity of care and the costs and all that sort of stuff. My thought is that they're probably just doing that to try and decrease the blame that's going to come their way from their failures across all of those sections.
Yeah, I mean, they've already done that in BC and Ontario, I think, right? Like, there's the privatization of LTCs and all kinds of care, like, I mean, what they've done to BC Cancer, right?
Right.
They're shipping people across the border to the state.
It's not working, right? No. Like, some people have been unable to even get the services even with that plan. So it's like the plans that they have are failing dramatically because these shortages are going to be everywhere, not just in Canada. So trying to sort of offset it to the U.S., like the U.S. is going to have healthcare shortages too, right? And we we have not focused on actually prioritizing the workers in these settings and making it the easiest that they can and supporting them to be in these environments, which we will, yeah, we're gonna regret that deeply, because we think healthcare bad is now. Like, give it another 5 years when people are sort of super burnt out, when the healthcare needs are increasing because of long COVID, right? Like, that's something that continues to be talked about, is that like the burden of care is going to keep increasing. And that's unfortunate. All I'm waiting for is to see them put long COVID as a made eligible condition, right? That will be the pinnacle of the just terrible, terrible plans that they've put together, is allowing all of these people and encouraging them in some sense to get sick, and then providing them the means to die so that they don't have to deal with the outcomes of it. That's where I see this going.
Yeah, because they're not going to get the top tier care. It's gone, right? Like, I have a friend that I've been friends with since I was, I guess, 15 years old. She recently came back into my life, and by just like literally moving in the same neighborhood as me, but she developed breast cancer. Like, went for, I told her to get a scan crystal in June because she showed me that lump, and I'm like, what is that? And then I'm like, go get scanned. She couldn't get an appointment until September, and by September it was diagnosed as stage 4, and then by October she had a double mastectomy. And my friend is a mom of 3 kids under 10. Yeah, that's how fast it was. It was from a weird lump in June to waiting to get it seen to having to get an emergency double mastectomy, and she's still waiting for chemo. Like, it's a mess,
right? And that we've lost all gains that we made in terms of prevention, right? That was such a push, that was the purpose of public health for so long, was to understand and to prevent the things that we have seen, and public health is gone. I mean, we see that all around us. There's no prevention of anything anymore. I'm looking at a fee schedule for a private clinic in Calgary. So this is, this includes like a head to toe assessment, and you get access to like physician, kinesiologist, dietitian, psychologist, and massage therapist, medical visits as necessary. They'll do your forms and stuff for you. So for the first year services, that's $5,500. So if you can afford that, then you can utilize their services and don't have to worry about not having a doctor or going to the walk-in or that sort of stuff. That's where it's headed, right? And
so it's like a membership fee?
Correct. It's like they call it an annual renewal fee. It's an initial fee and then an annual renewal fee for just under $4,000 after the first year. And that will get you 2 massage therapy, psych sessions, dietary consults a month, and then more importantly, medical visits as needed with a physician, right? So a family of 4, let's say, let me just get out my handy calculator here. So 2 adults would push you at about $11,000 services. And then children are free if their age is 18 and under. But if you have a young adult, 19 to 21, it's about $950 a year. So you're looking, if you're like a family of 2 with some children, it's probably about $12,000 to sign up.
Per year? Then,
for the first year. And then you get a discount after that, and it's going to be about $8,000-$9,000 a year.
Holy. And do they dictate which like providers you can see? Because in the US they call it out of network service. So if you have a health provider that's out of your health network, you're not allowed to use that doctor or specialist. And that's where privatization in the US has come.
Yeah, so this would be very specific providers that are associated with this team. And those are pretty much the only people that you can see.
Yeah, it's like the US. It's a US model. Have you ever watched that show, that documentary by Michael Moore Sicko?
Hilariously, though, there's 7 family physicians listed on this website as part of their team, and none of them are taking new patients right now. So they're already full up with their fees.
Wow. Ridiculous. And that's, we're heading the same way as where the US was 20 years ago, and it didn't work out well for them. So I don't know why we're choosing to go in that same direction. Like, wow.
Because the people that can afford it want their services. And the people that can't, they don't actually care about. It's exactly where it is, right? Is that I see this discussion all the time here in Alberta, that there's people that support this because they can pay the $5,500. And they're like, well, at least I'll get to see a doctor. And it's like, okay, but the people that can't afford that, what are they left with? They don't care. That's not their problem. Right. And that is the hyper individualism state and society that our own healthcare, public healthcare has pushed out. Right. Like I think of Dr. Bonnie Henry up there stating like about masks and vaccines. What did it all turn into? Well, it turned into whether you needed it or not to protect yourself. Who cares about the vulnerable people? Right. That is where the language that she went with. Over both of those things, right? Well, some people might need those, but not everybody, and we can ignore it if it's not us that's at risk.
She said it in such a kind voice. Whether or not the message was completely fascist, it's so fashy, but you know, that was the intention. It was to push the collective subconscious into a more fashy state where we no longer cared about each other. You do you.
Right. And it led to the same people that picketed hospitals because there was a mask mandate because they didn't want to wear a mask. That's where those sorts of statements led. Where instead of us as humans thinking about the fact that healthcare workers are going in there every day having to deal with this, that people now feel emboldened to harass and picket hospitals because they dare ask them to wear a mask. That's where that led us. Right? It led us to the place where we are now where hospitals don't have masks. That's wild. Think about the volume of vulnerable and sick people that are in a hospital. Right? And I know Barry Hunt has been doing a ton of education while he's been in the hospital. And has, you know, converted a lot of nurses and other medical staff to wearing masks while they're there through education. Yeah, but the fact that he had to do that in the first place is wild.
While he's getting knee surgery.
Right. Like, it's bonkers. It's bonkers. But maybe for today, we'll sort of wrap this up. And then I'll set up a space for another 2 weeks from now. I think that puts us at February 4th. And I'm going to put some messages out to people to see about maybe having a guest or two at that point. But yeah, we'll sort of keep rocking this every 2 weeks just to have a space to chat and catch up on things. I think it's been a bit of a clusterfuck in the Twitter community this past couple days with all the stuff that's been going on. And I see that there's a couple spaces open now where I think those conversations are continuing. So I'll be interested to catch up on those maybe. But yeah, I'm glad I get to hear your voice more, Mel, and that we'll sort of get back to doing this and, yeah, just have some open discussions about it.
Yeah. Open discussions and keep the communication lines open with our followers and listeners and, gosh, guys, we sure missed you. So,
yeah. And as always, right? Like if there's something that I say that bothers you, like reach out, talk to me about it. If there's research you have that negates something I've said, reach out, show me. Like I'm a person that wants to know that and have those conversations. I think that we all should be in a place where we're trying to learn. And I would like to at least model that for others.
Thank you. And with that, we're going to say good night. And
good night.
See you next time.
Oh, thank you.